Hey, how's things? Welcome to the Football Diary podcast. It's a rare weekend where both of our teams won. We won't be discussing United today, but we'll definitely be zooming in on Aston Villa and Miles Boys and how Pau Torres' return got them playing much more like Villa again, I think it's fair to say. Another influential player returning was Taiyo Awoniyi, who led Nottingham Forest to a 2-0 win over troubled West Ham. We'll analyse his impact for them as well. And also Chelsea and City drew 1-0. The optics of the title race obviously changed quite a bit with that result. But we'll start at Tottenham, where Wolves once again proved their growing stature in the Premier League this season, completing the double over Spurs with an impressive 2-1 win. Dave, welcome, mate. Hope you had a good weekend. Wolves, you've always been impressed by them since Gary Neil's been in charge, haven't you? Their front line especially is really one that catches the eye. And I think the way they set up against Spurs, it seems like a bit of a bogey team for them now, doesn't it? But they did the business again from a few different fronts. But what impressed you most about Wolves this weekend?
Absolutely. They've become a bit of a bogey team for them, haven't they? And there's been a couple of repeat performances and repeat games actually this weekend that we've seen earlier, or already seen earlier in the season, albeit in slightly different circumstances. But I thought Wolves performed really well. I think one thing as well at the minute, I think with the loss of Cunha as well, that's massive for them, really. And timely as ever, Hwang coming back in and filling that spot perfectly. But I thought the way that they actually performed in this game, I think they're just the perfect team, really. How they set up, Spurs just really found it hard to find space in behind them. They're just so rigid in their structure. And a few performers, I think, in this particular game, I think we need to highlight João Gomes, who's been, you know, really, really good for Wolves so far this season. Not particularly well known for the attacking side of his game, but you wouldn't think that. The way he took his two goals, particularly the second one, was outstanding. He's a player who's fully capable of getting from, you know, one side of the pitch up to the other, but for that second goal, and he allowed himself to get into the position for the strike, was, you know, out of this world. And you'd say it's probably a result that they deserved. And we speak about Wolves, it's almost like they found this stability in the team now, the balance that they've managed to find. Obviously, Neto coming back this season was a massive one for them. The creativity and the work that he does for the second goal, you know, is out of this world. And there's not many better forward players in the Premier League for me than Pedro Neto. And he's, you know, it's fully deserved all the attention, and I'm sure Wolves fans won't be liking the sort of the murmurs and the transfer rumours that are going around at the minute. There's a lot of the bigger teams are looking at him, but I thought I really expected Spurs to really take initiative, because they've actually, obviously, over the last few weeks, especially with the return of a lot of their players, obviously Maddison and Van der Ven coming back into the team, you just thought they've been showing this consistency. It was a surprise result for me, and especially with the loss of Cunha for Wolves, who's been a real talisman and danger man for them over the last few weeks. It's you know, it's got to be reassuring for Wolves fans to see that they're still putting the performances with the loss of those key players.
Gary O'Neill was saying in the post-match that he thought his team was faultless, and they kind of had to be, really, to take on Spurs, who are coming back to full strength as well. And I thought every player who was involved in the attacking phase especially played brilliantly. Again, you say Pedro Neto's work rate was fantastic and crucial for the second goal. And whether they hang on to him as well is going to be key to whether they can kick on next season. And how many seasons have we said that about Wolves' key players, you know, whether they can hold on to them. But he is definitely sort of the one at the minute, really, that you could almost put in that upper bracket, could play for any team in the league. But I was really impressed with just the way they dealt with Tottenham's attempt at pressing them and kind of comfortably passing it around them and pinging balls from wing to wing and you know, really making it difficult for Spurs to get a foothold on the game. But what was it about Wolves, do you think, Miles, that kind of impressed you, and which players kind of stood out in this performance?
Systemically, they were strong across the pitch, weren't they? That back three was really effective at kind of keeping Spurs out. They were really tight. Dawson and Kilman in particular, they're such excellent defenders. And Dawson is an experienced pro now, has really added a lot to that Wolves team, because he leads the back line so well. He commands the rest of his players around him. But also, he's quite effective on the ball going forward as well. He put an excellent ball into the box at one point And you'd think that it would come from a from their star midfielder instead of him. So I think their organisation was really strong, considering how little they had of the ball. They had to be patient. I think they had, what, 29% possession in this game, whereas the week before they'd had 70. So we're seeing that Wolves have actually got a lot of different dimensions to what they're capable of doing. And that's really impressive for a team of this sort of level. They're sitting 3 points off seventh all of a sudden, when we were talking about them as pretty much nailed on for relegation before a ball was kicked this season. So it's interesting how quickly they've turned things around. And actually, turning things around quickly was what they did in this game. Their counter-attack was just absolutely superb. Yeah. Neto, as we mentioned, he's electric. Sarabia, he's a quality footballer and offers a lot going forward. And it was really threatening. And it took Vicario some pretty impressive saves to keep Wolves from potentially scoring more in this game as well. So it is really encouraging for Wolves fans. They'll feel less encouraged by the talk that's surrounding them, that they kind of have to sell Neto in the summer just to keep up with FFP. And that feels, I don't know, it just doesn't feel nice, does it? When you see these clubs that are kicking on to a new level and are trying to keep up with the sort of top four, top five, top six, but they're then forced to sell their best players to those same clubs because they have to keep up with certain laws in place. And if Wolves lose Pedro Neto to Arsenal or Liverpool in the summer, for example, then they've got to start again. And realistically, we're not going to see them where they're kind of aiming for this season. That doesn't feel like that should be what FFP is there for. So there's a lot of really positive things around Wolves at the moment, but I'd like to see them hold on to the positives and keep that going for longer.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of players in Wolves who had a point to prove and a reputation to kind of back up. And I think seeing their reputations actually come to fruition and for the performances to match what we hoped and expected from some of these players has been the biggest turnaround for Wolves for me, because expectations were quite low. But I think the biggest kind of surpassing of expectations, Dave, was probably Gary O'Neill, and proving a lot of people wrong with his tactical acumen. And there's no coincidence, really, that he kind of counteracted Ange Ball twice this season, because I think he sees a clear way of doing that with the players he's got. And we talked about, obviously, the counter-attack and how they had to kind of be patient and wait for their moment, how they've been able to sort of evade that press quite comfortably as well. But I thought defensively, they were so disciplined, and that low block to try and frustrate Spurs kind of left them almost limited to chances from distance as well. I think respect for Gary O'Neill is still quite low, and I'm surprised at that. Do you think he deserves more credit to his name?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, obviously, Miles is perfectly right, and he's displayed fully how he can navigate his way through games. He's shown in these couple of games against Spurs this season, and that they are able to play in different, obviously use a weaponry to their own advantage. And we speak about, obviously, them being a counter-attacking. They're far more than just a counter-attacking team for me. I think the way they actually played this game, if you watch how many little chances Spurs, I mean, even the goal that Spurs scored, it was really well created by Kulusevski, and a little toe poke at the end through the goalkeeper's legs. It was a bit fortunate for my liking, and just how many chances that Wolves managed to limit them to just speaks volumes, I think, with how well they have played. And I think you're right, Miles. I think that the defence this season, and how far some of the players have come. I think Nelson Semedo has had a really good season, really solid, and he's always been earmarked as a player who's not been particularly great defensively, but his defensive game's come on so far. And the players that have just come into the squad, Ait Nouri is also not played every single week, but when he's come in, he's really stood out as well. So look, he's shown he's a manager that is fully capable and adapting to different situations, different games. And I fully agree. I just don't think he does get the credit that he probably deserves.
Well, I guess the question is now, Miles, if you look at the table, especially mid-table where Wolves are at 11th place, the teams above them arguably aren't performing as well, are they? I mean, Chelsea's forms are different. West Ham, as we know, we talked about last week in some depth, really struggling at the moment to gain any sort of traction and momentum. Newcastle even is an unknown quantity right now. I'm pretty sure they'll have them in their sights, surely. What do you reckon the hope and expectation is for Wolves fans now?
I don't know whether they'll have much like hope or expectation. I think this season almost becomes a bit of a free hit.
Yeah.
Because it seems like they are already exceeding what they would have expected. I think realistically, if you'd said to any Wolves fan at the start of the season, what would you like from this season? They would have said safety, aiming for mid-table. So the fact that they find themselves in a position where actually they could find themselves in the Conference League. That would be amazing for Wolves, because that was their vision, wasn't it? To get back in the Premier League and consolidate and then move for Europe. And they got to Europe really quickly when they got back promoted, obviously. And it kind of moved quicker than they intended to. So if they could get back to that point again, that'd be amazing for them.
Yeah, we were talking about West Ham, weren't we, last week, and their slide down the table and their, you know, the question about West Ham and David Moyes. And we'll go on to them next, really, because they're in that similar position to Wolves in the table, but two very different stories between the clubs and the feel around the club at the moment. But West Ham lost to a Nottingham Forest team that are in dire need of a string of games and a string of form, and crying out for that goal scorer really to finish off some of the great chances they were creating. And a first clean sheet for Forest since November in a 2-0 win over West Ham is probably just what they needed really to kind of kickstart them a little bit against the relegation threat they face. You know, obviously we talk about the points deductions that are looming, but they can only do what they can do on paper with the points on the board. And I think Taiyo Awoniyi in his return has made such a difference to Forest in this game, hasn't it, Dave? And I know you're a big fan of his style and what that adds to Nottingham Forest's play, but his finish, I think, was a prime example of how that works for Forest and how good he is for them.
Not necessarily just the finish. The touch was out of this world.
Yeah.
That was world-class, that touch, just the way he took the ball. There wasn't many better touches than that this season. I'd probably say Ollie Watkins' his goal against Fulham was similar in ilk. But the way he just caressed that into the far corner as well, it's actually, the potential is there for that front line of Forest, isn't it, really? But when he's starting, they just look so much more threatening, and they've got more cutting edge to them. But I think the promising thing for me is that Hudson-Odoi is almost all of a sudden starting to show signs of the player that we saw that he could be when he was obviously in his early days at Chelsea, Anthony Elanga. The amount of shots on goal, I think that would be the main thing for Forest in this particular game. The amount of shots they had on target and they only managed just to score two goals will probably still be an annoyance to them, because I think this performance was deserved of plenty more. I think there were a couple of moments in West Ham had. I think there was a really vital interception from Murillo, wasn't it? On
Antonio, I think it was.
Absolutely superb. Mm. Not really many more superlatives we'll say about him, but I'd be surprised if there'll be clubs line up for, if they can get someone can get him for 40, 50 million, I think that'd be a good deal. I think that just speaks of how good I think he can be as a player. I wouldn't be surprised to see a big club come in for him this summer, but you can see all of a sudden now that they're building momentum as a team, the club. There's a lot of positivity around them. I think they'll pull away from that relegation zone. I don't think they'll be in trouble.
Oh, that's the frustrating thing about Forest, though, isn't it? In some ways, they're so inconsistent and so stop-start that you see a great performance and then you see an absolute stinker the next week, and you see the lineup changing, you see the midfield pairings changing, the defensive pairings changing, and it's that kind of lack of consistency, I think, that's really setting them back. But I think in this game, Nuno Espirito Santo made some pretty brave calls about which players to leave out, which midfield and defensive pairings to kind of put together to counteract this West Ham team. And I know they were a bit lucky, Miles, weren't they, with Calvin Phillips' double yellow card and sending off. He's had a lot of bad luck this season, hasn't he? But I think they were on top before Phillips got sent off. Mm. And I think the midfield pairings, especially with Nicolas Dominguez, I thought he was fantastic, made such a difference for them.
Yeah, it's a difficult one with Forest, isn't it? Because performances do look strong at times, and they should, because some of the playing staff that they have there are excellent players. I feel very vindicated. Last week, you could cut to the footage. I said that I think that front four is far better than Forest's current league position.
Yeah.
And they shone this week and showed that. And I said that all it would need is Forest's defence to click into gear and support the strength of that attacking four. And that happened this week, and they got the result. So there is a lot for Forest to be hopeful about. The problem is, Dave talks about, I can see Forest getting away from the relegation picture. We don't know what the relegation picture looks like for Forest still. It's so unknown, because if they are hit with a deduction, then we can't say with any certainty that Forest are good enough to counteract that. That's the real shame. And Dave also mentioned like the momentum around the club building and there being a positivity around the fan base and the players. Again, that could be killed very quickly if the Premier League comes down on them harshly over something that seems really petty. So it's hard to say, but when you see a performance like this, West Ham, okay, it's probably an ideal time to play West Ham because they're in such poor form, yet to win this year. But this is a side that are in Europe right now. They obviously won a European trophy last year. They're in the top half of the league. they're not easy opposition for Forest to be playing. And you're talking about someone like Calvin Phillips, who, yeah, this was a mistake and he's maybe still finding time to settle into West Ham's midfield. But they've just brought him in from Man City. So obviously there's a player there. There is a lot of talent in that West Ham team, and Forest made them look very, very average.
Yeah.
And I think West Ham should be quite nervous about the fact that one team clearly had a much better attacking lineup than the other, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. On the attacking lineup as well, I just want to go back to Awoniyi as well and talk about the quality he brings. And he's scored or assisted 8 goals in 14 Premier League games this season. And Forest create a lot of chances, but when he's not there, you really do feel that lack of a focal point, don't you, Dave? And I think Awoniyi, his age and his profile and his stature and his physicality, I think he's one of those players as well they could struggle to hold on to if they don't stay in the league, don't you? Well, even if they do, I think he'd be targeted by a few teams who would look at that profile and go, yeah, that's just what we need as well.
I think there'd be a number of clubs. I think Newcastle United, they potentially could have a big miss in their obviously striker department, with obviously Callum Wilson looks like he's going to be leaving at the end of the season. Isak's had fitness issues, and not really, I wouldn't say he's so much of a similar player to Awoniyi, but you could see him doing a job, couldn't you, really? Like the form that he's showed, particularly his last couple of years, it's very rare that you see that sort of player who's so physical and so powerful, yet have got that turn of pace. He's, you know, for such a big guy, he's surprisingly quite agile as well. So I'm a big fan of him. I love to watch him, to be honest. But, you know, I'm sure Forest fans would love to keep him there at the club, all being well. To be honest, you mentioned about relegation. If they can sort out their defensive situation at set pieces, I think they'll be fine. But They're an absolute nightmare for conceding goals from corners and free kicks. It's happened so many times, and it was an issue when Steve Cooper was at the club as well.
I think Forest fans have had quite a few false dawns this season, haven't they? They're so frustrating, like I say, with the inconsistency. I guess the question is now, Miles, I mean, would they be able to capitalise on this in the next game and the next game and put a run together? And I think that's the major doubt against Nottingham Forest, is that they can do that. And they've got a lot of question marks now about selection. There's a headache there for Nuno to kind of pick the right team for the next game. Because he just does keep shuffling the pack a fair bit, doesn't he? Is there a settled first 11 for Forest? Because I think if there was, they'd probably have a better idea of whether they're going to stay up or not.
I think providing you keep everyone fit, I think the lineup that they went into this game with is their strongest that I can see. I don't think there'd be a lot that I would change about that. I mean, obviously, they've got players that will come back into the side, where ones that have contended in AFCON or with injury. But generally speaking, look, there's too much talent in that Forest team for them to be thinking about relegation. They're a better side than Burnley, Sheffield United, Everton, Luton. They are. They have much better players. I think the change in coach means that obviously you've got to allow that a bit of time to settle as well. I don't know whether Nuno is necessarily someone that Forest fans are enamoured by yet, but if he can keep them in the league whilst fighting off these charges and find his consistent 11, then great. But it's always going to take a coach time when they come in midway through a season to get to who they think their strongest team are, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah. I think goalkeeper's a big thing for them as well. They've had 3 different goalkeepers starting for them, and that can't help, can it, with the defensive stability, especially from set pieces. But I guess if it keeps becoming an issue, something's got to give. And I guess he feels like goalkeeper's the place where he can make the biggest difference. But I don't think there's any doubt of the talent elsewhere in the team. I don't think that's in any question whatsoever. But so, yeah, Forest climbing a little bit clear of the relegation zone for the time being, at least. And another team climbing the table back into the top four this time, Miles, is your boys Aston Villa, with an impressive win over Fulham. Ollie Watkins will rightfully take the headlines, I think, for his clinical brace. His finishes were both excellent. But there's another player you think made a bigger impact on Villa's play, especially their defensive shape this time around, and that's Pau Torres. Tell us what you think he brought to the team. And it's a back four that haven't played together so far as I'm aware. So it could have been so much different, but with Pau Torres at the back, that wasn't the case.
It's a repetition of my vindication. I've been saying for the longest time, the difference between Villa getting top four and not getting top four could be as simple as getting Pau Torres back fit. And in the last few games where Villa have kind of struggled, it was really clear that he was the player that they were missing, because he's by far their strongest centre-back these days in terms of his quality, his organisation, his defensive capabilities. But what he brings going forward is so important for the way that Aston Villa play football. And their willingness to play out from the back, play around teams that are pressing them high, that all comes from Torres. No player on the pitch had more touches or played more passes in this game than Torres. He just took to it straight away already. And he moved the ball over 1,000 yards in this game. Again, I think it was the sixth time he's done that this season. So he's really successful at getting things going for Villa. And actually, if you look at their second goal, the way the team move, the way that they link the play, the way that they pass the ball quickly, that fluidity is missing when you miss a player like Torres. Not even in moves that he's not involved in, you can see the team benefits from having his presence there. They know that that's how they can play. They feel more comfortable doing it. So I thought it was huge having him back. I'm really, really glad. It's difficult because when one comes back, another one goes out again. And Carlos picked up an injury in training. So now we've got Carlos, Konsa and Mings still out. Although by the sounds of things, Mings is making a far speedier recovery than anyone anticipated. Obviously, then we've got Kamara now out for the rest of the season, which is heartbreaking. Yeah. Your entire defensive structure has taken a battering this year. Your first choice back four have all been out for prolonged periods, and now your defensive midfielder is. But the way they counteracted that against Fulham was excellent. Tielemans was fantastic. I thought, again, his creativity, the chances he was creating in the game, really strong. His pass for Watkins for the second goal showed he has settled at Villa now. There were questions about him when he first joined, but now he's had a bit more of a run in the team, time training. He'll find his position in this squad, definitely, and I'm really pleased to have him.
Really like the sort of fullback partnership of Matty Cash on one side and Alex Moreno on the other. I feel like it's quite a dynamic pair. And obviously, Luca Dean, you've said in the past, you're not sure whether he'll get back into this team with that being the case. Are you confident that that's still the weakest area of the team? Because I know you said that in the past. That's kind of like the place you'd earmark to get a transfer in January. Obviously, that didn't happen. But does that still worry you a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. Only going into kind of bigger games, because what Emery has always liked to do, obviously, is have one quite attacking fullback and one that sits back and plays a lot deeper. That's why we saw Konsa kind of move to that spot. And for all of Cash and Moreno's strengths, they are both very attacking fullbacks. So it does leave you quite vulnerable. I find it really interesting that we play Cash as an attacking right back and Bailey just in front of him on the right hand side, mm-hmm. and play no real out and out left winger. It's kind of Ramsey that drifts out to the left hand side to support Moreno, but all of our play goes down the left. And I think when Luca Dean is fully fit, we might see a bit more of him. He's had a phenomenal season until that injury, but I think probably both positions are up for grabs in the summer window. So hopefully they show enough to get them into the top four by the end, because they're back there now.
Yeah.
They just have to keep it. Like that, I'd always rather be in that position. I'd rather it was in Villa's hands than anyone else's. We've got a couple of really winnable fixtures coming up, and then we have Spurs straight afterwards. Massive. Now, if we win our next three games, I'll say I'm confident we'll get top four. Right now, I still think we've got a few hurdles to get over, particularly with the injuries. But when you've got players like Torres coming back in and someone in the form of Ollie Watkins, like, we've got to talk about him in a minute, surely. Because he's just he's phenomenal now. 13 goals, 10 assists.
Yeah, that's unreal. I think my question for Dave was all Ollie Watkins based, to be honest, because obviously the concern, I think, at the start of this game for some Villa fans was this defensive, makeshift defence, especially two left-sided centre-backs with Clement Longley there as well.
That had a great game, by the way. Case,
who had a good game, yeah, but I think that was a Torres influence thing as well. Both very experienced defenders, but I think Torres marshalled that defence magnificently. But the clinical finishes from Ollie Watkins, Dave, were vintage Watkins, I think, from last season. Do you know when we were talking about him being probably in that world-class bracket? Those finishes were world-class, weren't they?
I think particularly the first one. I thought it's those kind of goals are just, I love to see them. It's just that they look so smooth. Obviously, the turn and the finish, it's almost all in one motion. But we know he's capable of that. And he obviously went through a bit of a dry spell at the beginning of the year, but particularly over the last couple of games, he's shown again what he's capable of, and it's gonna be interesting. Obviously, over the next couple of years, obviously Harry Kane's continuing, obviously hit 30 now. Obviously, the next couple of years, whether Watkins is going to be able to make that that position his own in that England team, because let's be honest, what is he 27, 28?
Peak years.
He's at that period in his career when he should be starting for his national team. You know, every single game. I'm sure if there was any, if Harry Kane wasn't around, he would be. It's a completely different player, let's be honest. He's fully capable of doing a little bit of everything in that front line. He makes a complete nuisance of himself constantly. He's always on the shoulder of the defender, looks to drop in, drifts out wide when he wants to as well. So it'll be fascinating to see if he does get that opportunity with England.
Well, that's the thing about Watkins that kind of fascinates me, is because there's not really many players like him. And I think for Villa as well, that's kind of a bit of a headache in some ways, because any injury to him, and it's very difficult to replace him, because he's so unique to the way that Villa play. He's so unique as a forward player as well in what he brings. So is that a concern for you as well? I'm not trying to nitpick fault here with Villa, because they were pretty damn good. But I'm just concerned about the amount of injuries Villa are getting. And he's one of those that if they did lose him for any extended period of time, top four suddenly looks very different, doesn't it?
It would be really difficult. Emi Martinez came out and talked about this after the game, actually. He was saying that the players that aren't injured, it's almost motivating them, because they know that they're the ones that can go and address things on the pitch almost for their fallen teammates. Like, three ACLs in one season is absolutely wild for any club to contend with.
Yeah.
It's really, really difficult. And if Villa were to lose Watkins, for example, that would have huge repercussions to our season. I trust that Emery would find a system that works. When you've got someone like Leon Bailey, who's in the form of his Aston Villa career, at least, if not his career, then we still have attacking outlets that can provide us with a lot. Let's not forget, we spent massive money on Moussa Diaby in the summer. He's not even starting games at the moment, but could fill in those sort of roles. Emery talked quite openly about how he saw Zaniolo as a striker as well, and someone that could support if Watkins wasn't around. So I think there actually is really good depth in the Villa squad. It's taken a beating with the injuries we've had, and all of a sudden our defensive depth looks really limited. But you'd think going into the season with five great centre-backs, then you're going to be fine. It's just typical that we're taking so many hits. I would like another out-and-out striker in the squad, for sure. But right now, when you've got the player who's got more goal and assist contributions than any other player in Europe's top five leagues, if you take away penalties, that's a pretty good record to have. I think he's been superb right now.
I think it's already shown, to be honest. I think the two biggest misses that you'll have in your team through injuries are going to be Pau Torres and Ollie Watkins. Pau Torres, take him out of your team. There's no other centre back in there that can play the way he does and orchestrate from the back. So I think you've got to get another centre back in the summer who's equally adept at being able to build from the back, because it just seems like you aren't able to play the same way without him.
Different style, but that's what Mings will do. Like, Mings likes to play the ball forward as well. He likes to carry the ball forward. And I think it's because we've not seen him all season, it's really easy to forget just how good Tyrone Mings has been for Aston Villa through periods of his career. Now, obviously, there was the period under Gerrard where that really stagnated, because they didn't like each other. But actually, as soon as Emery came in, Mings was absolutely crucial to Villa turning their season around. And you'd like to think when both of them are fit, if they stay fit, you've got two top quality left-footed centre-backs. I think they probably will both play most games anyway. But I think there are options. We've just been so unfortunate. Realistically, you ask any Villa fan, are you happy with the centre-back options going into the season if you have Mings, Torres, Carlos, Conser, Longley, and then Chambers as your sixth choice? We're all buzzing with that. We were all absolutely ecstatic about that. The fact that it's now down to the bare bones is so unfortunate. But I don't think I would sign much more, to be honest, to replace that, because you don't anticipate that happening again, surely.
Yeah, I think in terms of the squad depth, without the bad luck that Villa have had, you've got to be happy with the majority of positions, surely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the players we're able to bring off the bench, there have been some games this season where we've played elite opposition. I've looked at our bench and thought it was more threatening than theirs. So we've definitely got the players there. We just need the consistency of fitness and form with all of them. And then all of a sudden, we're beyond a top four contender. We're a cemented top four team. And that would be really, really great for us.
Let's move on to a tie, to an encounter that didn't exactly fill you with positivity, did it, Dave? I think you described it as almost like the derby of two teams that no one really wants to win. And that's Man City and Chelsea for various reasons. I mean, in the table, obviously, City are much more superior. So this was a big game in the title race, and Chelsea tried to sort of make their mark on it, I think, in quite an impressive way. It's one of the better Chelsea performances of the season, which is not saying an awful lot, but it ended 1-1. And I've seen a few comments saying that is this kind of the formula for trying to frustrate City and this title run, this title charge they always seem to go on? And they've taken 2 points off them. And they could have won the game, Chelsea, really, couldn't they? But for a relentless kind of City surge in the last 15, 20 minutes. But how did Chelsea frustrate City, do you think? What do you think they did to kind of tactically kind of nullify them for most of the game?
I don't think it's a secret of how to beat City. I think everyone knows that, you know, men behind the ball, perfectly well set up structure, obviously pressing in moments, not being too, I suppose, too over exuberant in nature when you're attacking. I think not committing too many bodies forward, because we know that when City have space to operate in, and they're in their element. And what we saw was in this particular game, I actually thought there wasn't one Chelsea player who had a bad game, to be honest. I thought everyone performed really well. They performed really well as a unit. I thought the two fullbacks played really well. I thought Chilwell, and I think that's probably Gusto's best game I've seen him have for Chelsea.
It was good.
And there's been times this season when I've watched and he's looked completely outsourced. I've wondered, where's this, you know, young talent that everyone was touting as, you know, really, really promising player, because I just wasn't seeing it at times. I wasn't seeing a player who could defend particularly well. But I thought he handled Doku really well. I've got to give him a lot of credit for that. I think he pocketed him pretty much all game, to be honest. And there were very few moments when he allowed him any space to kind of get in behind. So I think Man City in particular, I don't think they played that well, to be honest. Mm. I think they were too slow. I thought, particularly the first half, I thought they performed quite poorly. Chelsea made it look quite easy, could keep them out of those dangerous areas where they didn't want them to operate. I thought they were too slow passing the ball. The pace was just completely off. And they looked comfortable, Chelsea. They were good value for their lead for a good portion of the game. It wasn't until the second half, really, where it started to change.
Second half, I think, they were under the cosh massively. I think they faced over 30 shots. But tellingly, only 5 were on target. And Haaland missed a few really quite clear chances, I thought, that he'd normally put away. So I think Chelsea rode their luck to an extent, but you were talking about Gusto having a good game. I thought Axel Disasi had his best game in a Chelsea shirt. I thought he was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Conor Gallagher played really well. And I know, Miles, you've been kind of been an advocate for him being included more prominently in the England team, in that midfield. Who stood out for you for Chelsea? And is this something they can use, I guess, before we talk about the title race?
I think it is, yeah. And actually, Chelsea obviously have their cup final coming as well. So this is really good timing that they got this performance in now. They do seem like they are hitting a bit of form. I watched them against Palace and they got a win, but didn't look like they were actually that good. So it's good that they've now performed really well against City going into that Liverpool game. But yeah, Gallagher is the one for me that lately I've been really, really impressed with him. He's been everything for Chelsea because he somehow manages to perform the role of a number 6, a number 8 and a number 10 all in the same game. And he's had to fulfill those roles at different points in the season anyway. And that to me is why I look at him now and I think he's the obvious choice for England. I think a midfield of Rice, Bellingham and Gallagher is very multidimensional.
Quite balanced.
And can rotate between each other really, really well. Obviously, Gallagher has a bit of experience within the setup already. Mm. I think he has buckets of potential to improve as well. And I think that could be a midfield that England are looking at for years. I think he's been really, really strong. And it would be interesting to see what Chelsea do with him in the summer, because there's been widespread talk that he will move on because they can make pure profit on him as an academy player. But I don't see how they can afford to. He seems like their most important midfielder right now. Enzo is hitting in a lot of really good form now as well. But Caicedo could have been sent off in this game. So they haven't got a settled midfield yet. But Gallagher seems to be the one that is willing to carry everything forward and play like he's playing for Chelsea. Like when you've established a squad so quickly and brought players from all over the place, you need people who really understand the fabric of the club. And Gallagher, along with probably Reece James, are the two that you're looking to do that. With James's inconsistency with fitness, Gallagher, I think, has been an excellent leader in that camp. And I think he's shown a lot of real skill.
I think if I was a Chelsea fan, seeing somebody like Gallagher being put forward as, I know it's only a rumour, but being put forward as expendable almost. Like the club's gone through so much change. It's almost like their identity has been like washed away. You know, who are Chelsea? And I think the fact they've got players on these long-term contracts will really test how committed they are to making an identity. And, you know, they've got a lot of young players there from across the world, really, a lot of very international players. But to have a local boy in there, I think really keeps that sense of identity in some ways, doesn't it? So if they were to kind of consider Gallagher expendable, Dave, how would you feel if you were a Chelsea fan? Would that kind of change your view of your team in some ways?
I think it wouldn't sit well with me because, I mean, what was it? The Ben Chilwell, was he? I think he's the last player in that setup who appeared in that final Champions League final against Man City, which is crazy. I mean, this is what, 3 years ago? And, you know, it's not a long time at all. If you look at some of the players they've obviously got rid of, Mason Mount, Kai Havertz, obviously, as well. And it just seems like the turnover of players there is just crazy to me. There's obviously a lot of rumours of them looking to get a new recruitment manager in, isn't there? I think, is it Sam Jewell from Brighton?
Yeah.
Who obviously they're not happy with the recruitment and the players that they've brought in. So to get rid of one of your best performing players this season, for what? Because there's plenty of other players in there that should be really looking to get out of the door before him, if anything.
And supposedly to Spurs, if they do sell him as well. That seems so counterproductive. If you're trying to build for the future, strengthening a rival for the top four with one of your better players and an academy player, that seems like such an odd decision to make.
Yeah.
But that's Chelsea, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an odd one, isn't it? We'll go to Man City quickly as well before we finish the pod. And obviously this changes the dimension of the title race a bit, Miles, doesn't it? Because, yes, City still have that game in hand, but if they win it now, they're still behind Liverpool. And there's only, I think, would be, if that was the case, 2 points, 3 points separating the three teams, which is, again, amazingly tight and great for the neutral. It's just difficult to predict now, isn't it? I mean, we all thought City would just be dropping 0 points. I guess the next few games, we'll see how City respond to this, because they'll see this as almost like a defeat in some ways, won't they? But I think they've got like Brentford, Bournemouth, and then it's the Manchester Derby at the start of March as well. So it's a weird run of games they could do really well in. But how are you seeing the title race now? I ask this every week and it seems to change, but who's in the driving seat at the minute, do you think?
I don't actually know if I have the answer to that. And I know that's kind of pointless for a football podcast. You've asked me a question and my answer is, don't know. Should we just wrap up there? No.
Well, Liverpool and Arsenal both had convincing wins again. So
they did, but then Liverpool got battered by injuries. So now we don't know how long Alisson's out for. Jota got stretched off. Of course he did, because I made him my triple captain in my fantasy football this week. So that was really, really good. Nunes went off as well, so you never know with that. With City, how many times have you seen Haaland have a game like that and then the next game just be like, right, I'm going to destroy anyone in my path? Because, yeah, he probably should have scored 3 or 4 at this game, if we're honest. And on another day, he absolutely does bury every one of those chances, let alone just one of them. So, yeah, it was a bad day at the office for City, I think, because they had a lot of shots and they created, but they didn't feel like genuine chances half the time. And when they did, they lacked a clinical edge that we're not used to seeing Man City lack. Mm. It does feel like it's always Rodri that pops up with that one late on when they need it. I'm sure he's probably only scored 3 goals for Man City, but in my head, he's scored 20. He's always equalising late on, it feels like. But yeah, I don't know who I would say is in the driving seat. I mean, Arsenal's form at the moment, it's ridiculous. They've got 21 goals in the last 6 games, is it?
Since that break in Dubai, they've been rejuvenated, haven't
unbelievable.
They?
Unbelievable. Yeah, so City dropping points here, Arsenal continuing to get amazing results. Obviously, Liverpool got a really good result considering that they were also getting hit with injuries as well. It's the most open it's been for a long time. And hey, Villa are still only 8 points off, right?
So no clear answer from you because the door's still open for Villa, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, thanks. Exactly that.
I think my heart says Arsenal. Of course it does, because it's the lesser of three evils, isn't it? But I think my head probably says Liverpool because of the nature of the way Klopp's announced is leaving and how much that would galvanise Liverpool as a set of players to kind of go out from his tenure on such a high. It would be unbearable for Liverpool to win the league, to be fair. I'm not sure which would be worse, either them or City winning 4 in a row. Dave, how are you seeing the title race right now?
I agree with Miles. I think that injury to Jota and obviously Alisson, they're two massive injuries. And obviously, I actually thought Liverpool probably be the favourites before that happened, and it makes you step back and think again. Don't get me wrong, it keeps it, you know, entertaining for us all, and it's going to be unexpected sort of finish now until the end of the season. I think there'll be quite a lot of twists and turns, but I think Arsenal really have probably got their momentum with them at the minute. It seems they're on a real roll.
So no answer from you either then. Was that Arsenal? Is that Liverpool?
I'm going to go with Arsenal. Yeah.
Or anyone but City. No, I don't think Arsenal would be better than Liverpool would be better than City, to be fair, in my eyes. But a tasty title race nonetheless. Any other things stand out for you this weekend, guys? Any other things you want to kind of bring up before we wrap up?
Sheffield United are still very bad, and mainly because Mason Holgate is a very bad footballer.
Idiot. Oh, what a reckless challenge on Matoma as well after, 12 minutes to ruin their game.
Horrible, horrible challenge. But I think we're getting two goals for Brighton as well, and they're back up into seventh. That is impressive for them, because I feel like Brighton are going a bit under the radar. It felt like last season they were being talked about every single week and finished sixth. Well, they're seventh now and no one talks about them anymore. So
they've been indifferent, to be fair, but I think once they start playing European football again, we'll see what they've got, see what their squad's got as well. Anything stand out for you, Dave?
Well, we can celebrate another week of United getting a win.
By the skin of their teeth.
Too often these days. Rasmus Højlund, 7 goals in his last 6 games. I think he's the youngest player to score in 6 consecutive games in the Premier League as well, which is, it's a huge turnaround if you look at him not scoring in his first 14 Premier League games. I mean, who anticipated this?
No, nobody, to be fair, after the start he had. But that, I'll have to say, that finish he did with his chest was very definitely deliberate. That was like the motion towards the goal to kind of deflect it off Garnacho's shot. It was a deliberate goal, right?
I thought he was trying to get out of the way, I'll be honest.
He'll take it.
I wasn't sure. I thought he was trying to get out of the way. I really like Højlund, though. I think he's been amazing recently. Like, obviously, we did a video recently, Dave, didn't we, where we talk about the impact that Mainu, Højlund and Garnacho are having, these young players. And actually, one thing that I noticed watching United this week, I know we said we weren't going to talk about United, but you brought it up there. Watching how good Højlund and Garnacho look makes Rashford look worse to me. True. He looks really out of place in that front three at the moment. He just doesn't look up to the same scratch as them. Like, every now and again, he got into quite good positions in this game where he had like a speculative effort, and he just doesn't look as clinical anymore. And do you know what? I find Rashford such a weird player to watch, because now there's talk that PSG are going to look at him when Mbappe goes. I don't know with Rashford whether he's actually any good anymore. Yeah. Like, there was a period, obviously, where he blew teams away. It kind of, like Saka, for example, he reminded me a lot of Saka when he first came in. He could come in off the probably the other side, to be fair to him, and cut inside and really be devastating doing that. And Saka's maintained that and that confidence so far, and it seems like that's gone out of Rashford. So now he feels really ineffective. And now you've got someone like Højlund, who looks like that's actually Man United's future. And maybe you've gone past the Marcus Rashford era now.
I think there's too many players on a different wavelength in that team. And I think you're absolutely right, Miles. I think there's been a massive emphasis on team play, especially since Højlund's come in, the lack of service that he's been getting. And let's be honest, Rashford was used to being the main man last season. You know, he was winning games on his own. He was a match winner with the amount of goals that he scored. But it's not natural in his game to be a player who links play, can create chance, create opportunities. He's never been that sort of player. So,
would you sell him in the summer?
I'd take 60 million for him, to be honest. I would, because we've taken... Look, this was a transitional season. Obviously, the young players that have come in, Mainu, again, he's only 18. Garnacho's is in his second full season. Obviously, Højlund as well. We're creating this new team now where are we actually really losing much if we don't get Champions League this season? Then, which I don't think we will. I still don't think we will, to be honest. I don't think we look convincing still. Then what have we got to lose, really? If we sell Rashford to PSG, who have earmarked him apparently, put him on a shortlist and want to buy him. And I think it'll do well for him. I think it'll do a lot of good for Rashford just to go and see pastures new, because I think he just needs something fresh.
I think Sancho are the same in that respect, though, aren't they? They just need a clean break away from a pretty toxic environment.
I'm convinced Sancho would be doing better in this United team than Rashford. I'm still convinced by it.
Maybe.
If the changes to the hierarchy at Man United mean that in the summer they decide that Ten Hag's not the man, I would not be surprised if your front three next season was Sancho, Højlund and Garnacho. I would not be surprised at all.
Well, Sancho was more of a team player as well.
He's more of a team player than Rashford.
Yeah, of course he is. He'd be way better in a system. Way, way better.
I'm going to park the United talk there because we could go on and on. But that's where that's where we finished this week's pod. Thank you both. Thank you all for listening. And while you're here, actually, hop over to our YouTube channel. I say this every week, but it really does help us if you hit subscribe and look at some of our videos on there. Hit a like on them. Helps the algorithm and helps like-minded fans to find our channel, which is what we want in the end. But thank you, guys. See you soon.